She sang to me in dreams, long before I remembered her name. Now the melody has bled into reality, and so has she. Greystone wasn't just a hospital. It was her altar, and I was her offering. They said I was mad, but the water doesn't lie. The siren I forgot never forgot me. And now, she's taking back everything I ever stole, even my voice. The Lost Siren is a mind-bending psychological thriller where memory is a weapon, love is a curse, and drowning might be the only way out. Press play if you dare to remember.
Welcome to the Skillful Art of Manipulation. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today we present to you The Lost Siren, a free audiobook adventure awaits. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1, The Voice That Wasn't There. I've been told that the mind protects itself from trauma by building walls. Not fences, walls. Tall, thick, heavy things meant to keep the screaming locked inside and the questions buried deep enough to be mistaken for peace. That's what the doctors here at Greystone Institute like to say. They act like they're offering me insight, but really, they're just walling me in with new bricks. I've been in this place for 64 days. I know that because I carved the days into the back of my bed frame with the end of a paperclip I found under my mattress on day 3. I was bored, suicidally bored, but I didn't kill myself. I started counting. Every day I wake up to the same sterile white ceiling dotted with those little holes that look like inverted constellations. The fluorescent light above my head hums constantly, too quiet to complain about, too loud to ignore. I don't know if they do it on purpose, but it's maddening. Like my own private concert of mental erosion. The room smells like bleach and piss. The piss isn't mine. Greystone is a place where they keep people who've seen too much, lost too much, or done too much damage to themselves or others to function in the outside world. They call it a rehabilitation center, but I've met prisons that were more honest. There are 12 patients on the ward. 2 are nonverbal. One screams the Lord's Prayer every night at 3:11 a.m. sharp. The others just shuffle from meal to medication like ghosts. I don't talk to them. They don't talk to me. It's better that way. I'm here because, well, that part's blurry. They say I was found unconscious near the cliffs outside Driftmoor, naked, bleeding from the head, with a fractured wrist, and enough seawater in my lungs to drown a lesser man. They told me I had no ID, no phone, no wallet. Just a silver chain in my palm, and a word scratched into my arm with what looked like broken glass. Siren. All caps. Deep. Almost ritualistic. Dr. Morrow, my assigned psychiatrist, thinks it was a suicide attempt. She tells me I've repressed the memory as a means of psychological survival. Classic trauma response, she says. Amnesia. Dissociation. Possible hallucinations. She rattles off the clinical terms like bullets, hoping one will hit the target and crack me open. But I'm not hollow. I'm haunted. I hear her. At night, when it's quiet enough to notice the silence, she sings to me, not in full-blown verses, like something off a Spotify playlist. No, her voice comes in fragments. A few notes. A whisper of melody. Sometimes it's a hum threaded into the air like perfume. Sometimes it's just my name, spoken in a tone that makes my chest ache like I've forgotten something sacred. Elias. The first time I heard her, I thought I was dreaming. It was the fourth night. I'd refused my pills again, faked swallowing them and spit them into my pillow. I wanted clarity, not cotton in my brain. Around 2:30 a.m., I was lying awake, tracing cracks in the ceiling, when I heard it. Soft. Haunting. Like the echo of a lullaby from a memory I didn't know I had. It was so beautiful I cried. Not weeping, just tears falling soundlessly, one after the other, like my soul recognized something my brain didn't. I sat up in bed, heart racing, throat dry, and I said out loud without thinking, "Where are you?" No one answered. Of course not, but I swear the silence bent. Dr. Morrow calls it a complex hallucination, a manifestation of unmet emotional need. I called her a fucking liar. And that got me 5 days in the quiet room. 4 padded walls, no windows, and 1 dull bulb that never turned off. I didn't scream. I didn't beg. I just waited. Because the moment she said that, I knew it for certain. The voice wasn't imaginary. It was real. She's real. and I needed to remember why I forgot her. A week later, I found the corridor. I'd woken up with the sound of water in my ears, like waves crashing, far off but sharp. I followed it, walked past the nurse's station while they were distracted by some other poor bastard having a breakdown. Moved down the hallway past the rec room, turned right instead of left, and followed the flickering emergency lights. That's when I saw it. The old tunnel. Rusty, do not enter sign. Sealed with boards half rotted from moisture. I broke one off. The wood gave way like paper. I slipped through and kept walking. The air changed. Warmer. Wetter. Smelled like salt, mildew, and iron. The tunnel led to a staircase, spiral, cast iron, corroded with age. I descended, each step groaning like it was waking up after decades of silence. At the bottom, I found it. A stone room with a collapsed wall revealing a cavern. And in that cavern, water. Not a puddle. Not a leak. A hidden underground lake. Moonlight streamed through cracks in the rock above, lighting up the water in silver streaks. It was silent, impossibly still. No wind. No insects. No machines humming in the background. And then, her voice again. Come back to me, Elias. So clear, I turned around. No one. Just me, the water, and a comb. It lay there beside the pool, glinting faintly in the light. Silver, elegant, encrusted with tiny sea green stones. Still wet. I picked it up. My fingers tingled where they touched it. Suddenly, everything tilted. My vision swam. I saw flashes, her silhouette in the surf. Long black hair clinging to her back. Mouth opening in a scream I couldn't hear, hands reaching toward me from the waves. I dropped the comb. Stumbled backward. Fell to my knees. When I came to, I was in bed. Nurses hovering. For in my arm. Dr. Morrow's eyes cold and hard behind her glasses. She said I had a seizure. That I was found unconscious in the basement. That I'd never made it to the water. Said there was no underground lake. But my hand still smelled like salt. And my wrist, it had new scratches, thin and curved, like claw marks. Now every night I wait. I pretend to take the pills. I smile for the staff. I journal what they want to hear. But in my head I'm with her. The siren, the one they say doesn't exist. The one I may have died for, or killed for. The one I forgot, but I remember now. And she's calling me again. Tonight, I'll go back. And if I don't return, well, maybe I was never really here to begin with. Chapter 2. Her song in the walls. I didn't sleep. Not really. My body went through the motions, shutting down, slowing breath, numbing limbs, but my mind was wide awake, pacing. She was louder tonight. The voice wasn't just in the wind or the pipes. It was in the walls. It moved with the creaks of the building, threaded through every rusted bolt and cracked tile like her song had become part of the structure. I tried to ignore it. I recited facts in my head like Dr. Morrow taught me. Your name is Elias Reed. You were found on the coast, nearly drowned. You are in recovery. You are safe. But those weren't facts. They were statements of permission. They weren't real. They were granted. And permission can be revoked. I sat up slowly in bed, waiting for the moment the hallway lights dimmed. Exactly 3 a.m. That's when the staff changes. Shift rotation. A 7-minute gap in surveillance before new eyes take over the monitors. 7 minutes is all I needed. I slipped on the stolen keycard. Took it from Nurse Hannah last week when she left it on the cart beside my tray. She thinks she lost it in the laundry. I moved fast but quiet, like a ghost through the ward. The other patients stirred in their sleep, one muttering nonsense, another curled in a fetal ball on the floor beside his bed. Nobody noticed me. Or maybe they just didn't care anymore. The hospital hum faded behind me as I slid through the crack in the boarded tunnel door again, heart pounding in my ears like tribal drums before a sacrifice. The corridor was colder tonight. The walls seemed closer, like the whole building was holding its breath. My breath fogged the air. Every step echoed louder than it should have. I felt like I was descending into something ancient, older than the asylum, older than the town, maybe older than reason itself. By the time I reached the rusted staircase, my hands were shaking. Not from fear, but from hunger. A kind of pull that went deeper than bone. Like gravity. Like gravity had a scent, and it smelled like salt and forgotten lullabies. I climbed down into the cavern. Again. This time, the lake wasn't still. The water moved, not rippled, moved, like something beneath the surface it stirred. There was no wind, no sound, but I felt it. Then she sang, not a whisper, not a breath, a melody, three notes, minor key, sweet and sick with sadness. My knees buckled. I fell to the stone floor, clutching my chest like I'd been shot. The pain was sudden and vivid, like her voice was slicing through memories I didn't know were buried. And then, I saw her. Not fully, just a shape, half submerged in the water. Long dark hair clinging to pale shoulders. A flash of silver where her wrist met the moonlight. She didn't look at me. She sang to the lake, to the stone, to the air itself. And I remembered something. A girl, on a pier, her back to me. Summer light, the sound of gulls. She was humming the same melody. I tried to reach her. My hand out, my mouth open. But the memory dissolved. It always does. I stood, swaying, feet sliding against damp rock. Who are you? I whispered. She stopped singing. Slowly, she turned her face toward me and vanished. Like mist blown off a candle flame. No splash. No ripple. Gone. I stayed for what felt like hours, hoping she'd return. Hoping it wasn't a hallucination. That I hadn't cracked open completely. Eventually, I made my way back to my room. I don't remember how. I just woke up there, clothes wet, shoes caked in black moss. And on my pillow, a single strand of long, black hair. Still damp. Dr. Morrow's voice is more forceful now. Less clinical, more cornered. She knows something's changing in me. She says I've stopped participating in group therapy. Stopped making eye contact. That I'm withdrawing. Of course I am. She wants me to forget the only real thing I've ever known. She wants to drown me in pills until the voice is silenced. But she doesn't understand. I've already drowned once. And I didn't stay dead. I broke into the records room last night. I needed to know if there was any mention of this place, the cavern, the lake beneath the hospital. I found blueprints, yellowed and stained. No mention of a lower level. But one thing stood out. The Institute wasn't always a hospital. It used to be a sanatorium. And before that, a monastery, 13th century, built over a fault line near the sea. Old gods, strange rites, drowned saints. I read until my eyes burned. One passage, scrawled in Latin, barely legible, translated to, "She who sings beneath will awaken what was never meant to rise." What the fuck does that mean? Who built this place? And why is she under it? The dreams are getting stronger. Last night I saw the ocean. Endless. Black. Lit only by the moon. She was sitting on a rock, singing to a storm. Naked, blood on her thighs. A ship burning in the distance. Men screaming. She looked back at me, her eyes full of sorrow. Not guilt. Not remorse. Just sorrow. Like she didn't want to do it. But she had to. I woke up to find my hands soaked in seaweed, wrapped tight around my wrists. Like cuffs. No one could explain it. They sedated me again. But this time, I welcome the sleep. Because now I know she's trapped. And I'm the only one who can reach her. They think I'm losing my mind. Maybe I am. But it's the only way to find hers. Because she's calling me again. Only this time, it's not just a song. It's a message. A warning. And if I don't listen, someone else will. And they won't survive her. Chapter 3. The Woman in the Water. There are two kinds of silence. There's the peaceful kind, the still, sleepy quiet of a world at rest. The kind you get right after a storm clears or when the power goes out and the world forgets to hum. Then there's the other kind, the silence that screams. The silence I woke up to. It came after the dream, if you can call it that. But it didn't feel like a dream. It felt like a memory clawing its way back up through the rot and rust of my mind, soaked in salt and shame. I saw her again. Not as a shadow, not a shimmer, but as a woman. She stood waist-deep in black water, hair trailing like ink, eyes wide and glassy and endless. Her mouth didn't move, but I could hear the song inside my head. Not just a sound, but a sensation. Warmth, hunger, grief. She was singing directly into my blood. I reached out, and she pulled me under. When I woke up, the silence was waiting. My room was dark. The light bulb above my bed cracked and flickering like it had tried to warn me of something before dying. My blankets were soaked. The floor beneath my bed was puddled in seawater, salt crusted at the corners of my mouth. No one believed me. Again, the nurses replaced the bulb, gave me a towel, jotted notes, pretended not to see the algae smeared on the soles of my feet. Dr. Morrow upped my meds. She said the stress of repressed trauma was manifesting as increasingly vivid hallucinations and psychosomatic symptoms. She used words like displacement and dissociation. But I noticed something else. She wouldn't meet my eyes. There's something else going on in this place. Something even the staff doesn't understand. Or worse, something they've agreed not to talk about. Because it's not just me hearing the music anymore. Old Manny, the patient who normally stares at the corner of the wall for hours, started humming under his breath yesterday. The same tune, almost note for note. When I leaned in and asked him where he'd heard it, he blinked like he was waking from a trance and said, "She's under the floor, waiting for her lover." I asked him who. He laughed and whispered, "You." Then he went back to staring at the wall. I tried to act normal after that. Eat. Participate in group. Smile. But something shifted inside me. I wasn't just haunted anymore. I was claimed. That night, I returned to the cavern. This time, I didn't sneak. I walked, deliberate and slow, like something ancient had risen in me and stripped away fear like old paint. I didn't check the cameras. I didn't flinch at the creaking wood or the dripping stone. I belonged to the dark now. The lake welcomed me. The water shimmered, low tide revealing moss-covered stones and a narrow trail leading farther around the bend of the cavern wall. I hadn't noticed it before. Or maybe it hadn't been there before. This place is alive. Shifting. I follow the path. Barefoot. The rocks cut my skin, but I didn't care. I was following a pull deeper than pain. Eventually, the trail led to a grotto carved by time and tide, hidden from the main chamber, veiled by hanging moss and trickling water. And there she was. Not a ghost. Not a figment. Her. Sitting on a stone slab like a throne, dress soaked and clinging to her body like it feared losing her. She was breathtaking, not in a beautiful way, but in a way that hurt to look at. Her skin was pale, pearlescent in the moonlight leaking through the cracks above. Her eyes were liquid obsidian. Her lips parted, but no sound came out. I stepped closer. She didn't flinch. I whispered, "What are you?" "And this fucking time," she answered. Her voice didn't come from her mouth. It came from inside my head. I am the wound in your memory. The salt on your regret. The part of you they buried. Her voice felt like a thousand truths spoken at once. None of them mine. I asked, "Why me?" Her eyes locked onto mine. "Because you sang to me first." The world fractured. Suddenly, I was underwater. Not physically, but mentally. Like my brain had been dunked into a tank of memory and forced to inhale. I saw myself on a boat. Drifting. Night. Storm. A woman screaming. Water flooding in. My hands on the wheel. Her voice calling me back. Then, a hand on my shoulder. Her hand. Pulling me toward the edge. Telling me to jump. I gasped. Fell backward. Slammed into stone. I was back in the cavern, lungs heaving, vision white hot. She was gone again. Only the echoes of her voice remained, buzzing inside my skull like static in a broken radio. I screamed into the dark. "What the fuck did you do to me?" And the water answered. Not with words. With movement. A wave rose from the lake, just enough to slap against the stone, leaving behind something small and metallic. A ring. Silver. Bent. I picked it up. Inside was an engraving. E plus C. Always. I don't know who C is. But I know this ring was mine. The fit. The shape. The feeling in my chest when I touched it. Another piece of me. Another memory returned from the dead. I tucked it into my pocket, climbed the stairs, and as I walked back into the main hallway of the Institute, I passed by a display I'd never noticed before, an old photo behind glass, dated 1927. Black and white, blurry, but clear enough, the original Greystone Sanatorium staff. And there, in the back row, half faded and grainy, was her. Hair tied back. Dark eyes. Wearing a nurse's uniform. She hadn't aged a day. That night, I didn't sleep. Couldn't. Because if she's real, if she's lived this long, if I loved her once and forgot her, then what the hell did I do to deserve her rage? And why does she want me back? Chapter 4. I remember drowning. I used to think madness was chaos. Screaming. Thrashing. Foam at the mouth. That cartoonish version the movies like to sell you, the kind where people claw at walls and pull out their hair and cry out to invisible gods. But madness isn't loud. Not at first. It's slow. Creeping. Polite even. It taps at the edges of your mind like a polite guest asking to come in. Just for a second. Just to leave something behind. And before you know it, it's living there. It rearranges your furniture, steals your mirrors, burns your maps, and then it starts whispering in your own voice. That's what it felt like when I stood in the common room, holding the ring she left me. The metal was warm against my palm, even though the room was cold. It throbbed like a heartbeat. I swore I could feel it vibrating, almost humming, like a tuning fork strummed by unseen hands. E plus C. I didn't know who C was, but I could feel her underneath my skin now, sulking in the cracks of my thoughts, threading herself between the syllables of my name. And the worst part, I liked it. Dr. Morrow called me in for another session. She said she was concerned about my progress. Translation, I'm not broken the way she expected me to be. She watched me like a puzzle she couldn't quite finish. Her pen hovered above her notebook like she didn't know which part of me to dissect first. Tell me about the ring, she said. I didn't flinch. What ring? She tilted her head. The one the nurses found under your pillow. Of course they had. I should have known better than to sleep with it in my hand. They go through our shit when we're out. Strip us bare, literally and figuratively. I shrugged. Probably belonged to another patient. Her gaze lingered on me. It's engraved. Lots of rings are. But this one seems to have calmed you. Since you found it, your insomnia has stabilized. Your aggression's gone down. Your pulse lowered. I leaned forward, elbows on my knees, and smiled. Maybe love really does heal all wounds. She didn't laugh. She wrote something down instead. That night, I dreamed of drowning. Not abstract drowning. Not a metaphor for guilt or helplessness. I mean actual drowning. Lungs burning, water forcing itself into me, throat collapsing around the pressure. But here's the thing. I wasn't panicking. I wasn't even fighting. I was staring up at the surface, watching moonlight dance on the water above me like it was a glass ceiling. And she was up there, floating, watching, waiting, not saving me, not killing me, just watching. She reached out, fingertips brushing the water above me. Her lips moved, but the water garbled her voice. Still, I could feel the words inside me. You wanted to forget, but I never let go. I woke up choking. Not metaphorically, literally choking on seawater. I vomited it onto the floor. Nurses burst in. Screamed for suction. Dr. Morrow was called at 4:11 a.m. She stood in the doorway, not shocked. Not angry. Just staring. They kept me in the observation wing for 2 days after that. 4-point restraints. Constant vitals. More pills I didn't swallow. But here's what they didn't find. They didn't find the ring. Because it was in my stomach. I swallowed it after the dream. I felt it inside me, burning like a promise I couldn't forget. On the third day, they moved me back to the general ward. Morrow claimed I was stabilizing. That the hallucinations were a symptom of post-traumatic recovery, not worsening psychosis. She doesn't understand. Or maybe she does. But I understand now. Because I finally remembered what C stands for. Her name was Corinne. She was real. I remember the sound of her laugh now. Hi. Effortless. Unfiltered. Like music from someone who'd never been hurt. I remember holding her hand in the sand. I remember the silver ring she used to wear, the one with the engraving she added herself after we got drunk on her birthday. I remember the night we stood on the cliffs. Arguing. Screaming. She accused me of something. I don't remember what. Maybe I cheated. Maybe I lied. Maybe I forgot. She was crying. She ran. And then nothing. Just water. And silence. I killed her. No. No, I. Maybe. But why would she be alive? Why would she be here, beneath this place, singing to me like some myth-given flesh? Unless she was never human to begin with. Unless I was just the latest man to fall for a song that's never truly meant to be loved, only feared. I went back to the lake that night. My legs barely carried me. My hands shook. But she was waiting. This time, not in the water. She was on the stone again, dry, dressed in a sea-gray gown that shimmered like fish scales. Her eyes were dark and wide, bottomless, filled with something between mercy and malice. I dropped to my knees. "What are you?" She didn't blink, didn't breathe. "I am what you made me." Then she showed me. Not with words, with touch. She placed her hand on my chest, and the cavern dissolved around us. Suddenly, I was back there. The night of the fall. The cliff. Her voice. We were arguing. Loud. Wild. She said I'd lied. She said I'd used her. That I only loved the way she made me feel, not who she was. And I pushed her. Not hard. Just enough. Enough to make her stumble. Enough to let gravity finish what my rage began. The memory shattered like a mirror dropped into the sea. I was on the stone again, vomiting. She stood above me. Silent. Still. Beautiful and broken. You begged to forget. And I forgave you. But now you remember. And forgiveness has a price. Her voice pierced my ears like sirens. Not her song, the real ones. The hospital had triggered lockdown. They were looking for me. But I didn't move. I looked at her. Eyes burning. Voice raw. What are you going to do to me? She tilted her head. Not yet, Elias. You're not ready to pay. Then she turned to water. Collapsed into the pool like a dress made of smoke. Gone. I stumbled back to my room before they found me. Collapsed in bed. Shivering. Wet. Heartbeat erratic. I reached into my throat. Fingers bleeding. And coughed up the ring. It landed on my pillow. Still shining. Still engraved. Still waiting. Chapter 5. Her voice in their mouths. They say grief is heavy. That it sits on your chest like a body you can't move. But that's not grief. That's guilt. And guilt is much worse. Grief is mourning something lost. Guilt is mourning what you destroyed. I don't know how I made it back to my room that night. I don't remember the walk, or the door, or the nurse who saw me and screamed when she realized I was covered in blood and lake water. I only remember the ring, warm again, pulsing against my chest like it was feeding off the truth I finally faced. I killed Corinne. And now, she's not letting me forget it. The next morning, the hospital changed. Subtly. Slowly. Like the walls were breathing differently. The nurses walked softer. The air was thicker. The lights flickered in unspoken rhythm. I caught one of the orderlies, Brian, humming the melody she always sang to me, completely unaware he was doing it. When I asked him about it, he blinked like I just pulled him out of a trance and stammered something about a song on the radio. There are no radios in Greystone. Only her. During group therapy, things got worse. We were sitting in the circle, pretending to participate, pretending to be stable enough for discharge, when Lila, the girl with the burn scars on her arms, suddenly snapped her head toward me and began singing. It wasn't loud. It wasn't even musical. But it was hers. The same three notes I've heard 1,000 times in my dreams, in the walls and the waves. I froze. So did everyone else. Dr. Morrow asked her to stop, gently at first. Then more forcefully. But Lila didn't stop. She stared straight at me, eyes glassy and distant, mouth curved into a soft, sad smile, and she sang until her voice cracked, and then kept going, dry, hoarse, bleeding. I stood, backed away. My chair toppled. That's when she screamed. A single, high-pitched cry that sounded like something ancient and wrong being pulled into the air. Blood began to trickle from her nose. Then she collapsed. They rushed her out. I wasn't allowed to see her again. Dr. Morrow called it a seizure. A stress response, she said. Coincidence. But I know what I saw. Corinne is in the walls now. And she's spreading. That night I dreamt of the sea. But not like before. This wasn't just water. This was her memory. I was in her body. Or maybe behind her eyes. As she floated just beneath the surface. Watching a ship go down in flames. Dozens of men screaming. Drowning. Some impaled on splintered masts. And we watched. Not passively. Hungrily. I felt her power as if it were my own. The way she pulled sound from her throat and turned it into something that shattered bone. The way her song made men beg. Not for life, but for death. But in that moment, she wept. Why? Because among those men, one was different. One was hers. I woke up with tears streaming down my face. and in my hand a pearl. Perfect. Pale. Wet. I had left my room. The door was locked. The window sealed. Still, it was real. I held it under my tongue the rest of the day, unsure whether swallowing it would kill me or awaken something else entirely. Dr. Morrow called me again. Her office was different this time. Colder. Darker. She asked me how I was feeling. I told her the truth. "Current's not a ghost," I said. "She's a current." Morrow raised an eyebrow. "A current? She doesn't haunt. She moves. She infects. Like water in your lungs, or a song stuck in your head that you didn't choose to hear." "You believe she's possessing people?" "No. Possession implies they can fight it." I leaned forward, voice low. "She's drowning them from the inside out." Morrow didn't speak for a moment. Then she said, "Do you think you deserve to be drowned?" I didn't answer, because in that moment I saw it. The ring. Around her neck. My ring. The one I swallowed. The one I coughed up. The one I kept hidden. Hanging from her chain like it had always been there. "Where did you get that?" I whispered. She looked confused. Glanced down. Then smiled. Just a twitch. A flicker of something that wasn't entirely hers. "Oh," she said. "It was a gift. That night I didn't dream. Because I didn't sleep. I stood in the center of my room, fists clenched, trying to remember where the cracks in the wall were. Where the voices lived. I banged on the plaster until my knuckles bled. Until someone sedated me. I think I screamed her name. I think she screamed mine back. The following day, I was banned from the common areas. Morrow said I was triggering instability. I was ordered to remain in isolation until further notice. But it didn't matter. Because now the siren didn't need tunnels or pools or dreams. She had found her way into people. I could hear her in Nurse Hannah's whisper when she gave me meds. In the rattle of the food tray, delivered at 4 p.m. In the tremble of the lights as they blinked in a rhythm that matched the beat of her melody. She was everywhere. And I was the epicenter. I stared into the mirror. And I saw her. Not behind me. In me. My reflection wavered. My skin grew pale, almost translucent. My eyes darkened. My lips moved, but the voice I heard wasn't mine. "Do you remember, Elias? The night you promised never to leave." My mouth opened. I gasped. "You broke it. Now I'll break you." I punched the mirror. Glass sliced my hand open. I watched blood drip like ink onto the sink basin. But the pain didn't come. Only her voice did. Soft. Crooning. Like a lover after the fight's over. "Let go. Let me in again." I staggered back from the mirror. Collapsed onto the floor. The pearl still under my tongue. I bit down on it, hard. It shattered. And the moment it did, I remembered everything. The way I'd first met her. Not Corinne as a woman, but Corinne as a myth. The strange woman on the beach when I was 17. Singing to the waves. Naked. Beautiful. Begging me to stay. And I did. For 7 nights. She fed me stories and songs. Touched my soul before she ever touched my body. Said I belonged to the sea. Said she'd wait forever. And then I left. And I forgot. Until she found a way back. Until she made herself flesh again. Until I fell in love a second time with a girl named Corinne and didn't even know it was her. And when I betrayed her again, she woke up. And now, she's no longer hiding. She's building something. Feeding off the hospital's grief, pain, silence. Turning the weak into her choir. Turning me into her anchor. And the worst part, I think I'm ready to sing. Chapter 6, The Choir Beneath the Floorboards. I used to believe in logic. I clung to it like a lifeline. Cause and effect. Action and consequence. A world made of straight lines and rules you could trace with a pen. Logic was the last god I believed in. But this place, this thing I've stumbled into, it feeds on emotion, not reason. It blossoms in silence, takes root in grief, and flowers in guilt. It doesn't care about what's real. It only cares about what you feel. And I feel her. Everywhere. She's not hiding anymore. She's not humming lullabies in the cracks. She's singing now. Full-throated. Triumphant. Echoing through the bones of this building like it was built just to be her cathedral. And the worst part, people are listening. It started with Nurse Hannah. She stopped speaking in full sentences. Just fragments. Lyrics. Questions that didn't make sense. "You can't hear the waves, can you?" she asked, smiling as she poured my meds. Then, she remembers you. Even now. I asked her who she was, but her eyes had already glazed over. Then Brian went missing. The orderly, the one who hummed her tune without knowing. Gone. No explanation. His locker was left open. Inside were damp footprints and seaweed coiled like a necklace around his stethoscope. Nobody talks about him. His name hasn't been mentioned once since. It's like he never existed. Three more patients had breakdowns in the last week. One girl scratched the word siren into her thigh using a plastic fork. Another kept whispering, "She has your heart. She has your name. She's not who you think she is." The third tried to drown herself in the sink. She said she needed to make space for the song. Dr. Morrow still insists it's a shared psychotic delusion. Mass hysteria. That's what she's calling it. I don't believe her. I think she's already infected. Last night, I returned to the cove. Not because I wanted to. Because I had to. The pull was unbearable. My chest felt like it was going to cave in if I didn't get closer. My ears rang with silence, the kind that only breaks when she lets it. I passed through the tunnel. Down the stairs. Past the cracks in the stone. Past the echoes of my own past. And I saw them. The others. Not just shadows now. Not hallucinations. People. Half naked. Eyes glazed. Standing knee-deep in the black water. All of them facing the same direction. Toward her. Corinne stood at the center of the lake. Dry as bone. Her hair billowing in wind that didn't touch anyone else. Her gown clung to her like it was alive. And she was singing. No words. Just sound. It wasn't music. It was a summons. I watched as one of the patients, Alan, I think, stepped deeper into the water. Mouth open. Smiling. He didn't swim. He didn't float. He sank. Slowly. Peacefully. As if he'd been waiting his whole life to return to her. I tried to move. To scream. But I couldn't. Because somewhere deep in my bones, I wanted to join him. She turned to me. Her eyes locked onto mine. And in that moment, I didn't see her as a monster. I saw her as a mirror. All the pain I'd buried. All the parts of me I tried to amputate. My guilt. My cowardice. My hunger for something beyond the dry bones of a rational life. She saw all of it. And she loved me anyway. Or maybe she loved the weakness. I couldn't tell anymore. She raised a hand, and I stepped forward. My feet entered the water. Warm. Welcoming. Alive. Her voice reached into my head like fingers pushing through clay. I gave you the sea. You gave me silence. I tried to speak. To apologize. To explain that I was afraid. You begged to forget. So I became forgettable. Her fingers grazed my face. But now you remember. And the debt must be paid. I fell to my knees. Water rushed into my mouth. I choked. Spat. Sputtered. I saw flashes behind my eyes, like static from broken memories. The night I left her. The way her voice cracked when I told her I didn't believe in fate. The scream she made when I stepped onto that boat. The last look in her eyes when the fog swallowed the shore. She didn't cry. She sang. She always sang. Suddenly, the world tilted. I was no longer in the lake. I was on the cliffs again. Wind howling. Rain slicing through darkness. She stood before me. Soaked. Furious, radiant. I begged her not to jump. But this time, she didn't. She turned to me. And pushed me instead. I fell. Fell for what felt like days. I hit the floor of my room. Back in Greystone. Soaked. Naked. Shivering. The pearl was gone. The ring. Back on my finger. And carved into my forearm, in letters too perfect to be my own. Singer drown. Morrow visited me the next day. She had bruises on her neck. Fingertips. She didn't mention them. She just stared. "You've changed," she said. "You're starting to hear it too," I whispered. She didn't deny it. She leaned forward. "Tell me how to make it stop." And I laughed. Hard. Bitter. "You can't stop the tide, Doc. You either learn to breathe underwater, or you drown like the rest." That night, the alarms blared. Code black. Evacuation protocol triggered. But nobody ran. They just stood there. All the patients. All the staff. Silent. Still. Listening. The melody crawled through the walls like smoke. Sweet. Poisonous. Irresistible. I stood in the center of the ward. The lights flickered, the floor shook, and then the singing began. Dozens of voices, in perfect harmony, not trained, not practiced, claimed. I screamed her name, screamed until my throat bled. Corinne, she answered, not from the water, from within me. I collapsed, convulsed, dreamed of a kingdom beneath the waves, of a throne made of driftwood and bone, of a crown she placed on my head as her lover, her betrayer, her prophet. She whispered, "You wanted to forget me. Now you'll make them remember." I woke up to the hospital on fire, but there were no flames, just water, pouring from vents, lights, cracks in the floor, flooding the halls. One nurse tried to run. She slipped, fell, and the water swallowed her like a mouth. Another patient danced in it, joyful, wild, baptized in madness. And me, I stood in the eye of the storm and sang. Chapter 7, The Price of a Song. They'll write about this place one day. They'll call it a tragedy, an institutional failure, a mass psychosis event. They'll blame faulty infrastructure, water damage, an electrical surge that sparked hallucinations, maybe even a gas leak. They'll bury the truth in science the same way I buried Corinne in memory. But what they won't say, what they'll never dare to whisper, is that this place didn't fall apart. It drowned, and I was the one who opened the floodgates. The water is everywhere now. No longer just in the cove, no longer hidden. It spills from ceilings, from power sockets, from cracks in the concrete that didn't exist the day before. It oozes up from floorboards like the building itself has begun to weep. I've stopped counting how many have vanished into it. The staff are all gone, at least the parts of them that used to resist. Now they drift silently through the hallways like they're underwater, blank-eyed and barefoot, humming her tune, singing in unison, as if they were born knowing the words. Greystone is no longer a hospital. It's a choir, and she's the only conductor. I stood in the middle of the flooded main ward this morning, waist-deep in dark water that pulsed with light like the veins of some ancient god. Around me, patients floated, some singing, some silent, all lost. The air smelled of salt and rot, and something older than language. And in the center of it all stood Corinne. Not the Corinne I remembered, not the girl I loved, not even the myth I betrayed, but something new, something born from both. Her body shimmered like glass. Her eyes were moons, black and full of gravity. Her voice was layered now, hers and mine and everyone's. The sound of grief made immortal. She opened her mouth and spoke, not into my ears, into my bones. "You remember now, and so do they. You brought them to me." I wanted to say no. I wanted to scream that I didn't mean to, that I was just trying to remember who I was, not rip the seams between worlds. But the truth is, I did mean to, because I missed her, because I never let her go, because forgetting her felt like killing her again every day. "What do you want?" I whispered, tears sliding down my face and into the water. "What I was promised," she said. "A love that never leaves, a voice that never silences, a world where I cannot be forgotten." She reached out her hand. Her fingers dripped silver light. "Sing with me, and I will never be alone again." And in that moment, I almost said yes, because I could feel the weight of it. The centuries of loneliness, the ache of betrayal, the desperation of a creature forced to become a myth because the world wouldn't give her permission to be real. I remembered what it felt like to drown in her once before, and I longed for that silence again, that perfect stillness. But then I saw them. Lila, Brian, Hannah, their bodies limp, mouths open, eyes empty. They weren't singing because they believed in her. They were singing because they had no choice left. And I realized she hadn't freed them. She'd hollowed them, just like she tried to hollow me. "I loved you," I said, my voice raw. "I still do." She blinked slowly, no emotion. "But love without freedom isn't love. It's control." Her fingers curled. The waters around me began to churn. "I gave you everything," she said. "I let you forget. I let you live. You let me lie to myself. That's not mercy." Her face twisted just slightly, the mask cracking. "Then choose, Elias. Drown with me, or die forgetting again." The water rose, faster, angrier. It wrapped around my throat like hands. I could feel her rage in every drop, centuries of silence breaking into a scream. The walls shuddered, the lights exploded, and in the chaos, I remembered the only thing that ever calmed her. My voice, not as a follower, not as a prisoner, as her equal. So I sang, not her song, not her melody, mine, a broken, trembling thing, out of tune, out of breath, but it was mine, and it stopped her cold. She stared at me, stunned, because I wasn't singing for her. I was singing for me. The room cracked, the ceiling split, water rushed upward instead of down, like it was being called back to the stars. The bodies floated higher, the air grew sharp. Corinne stepped back. No, she said, voice thin. No, not again. I stepped forward. You want to be remembered? I'll remember you. Every day. Every breath. But I won't let you take anyone else with you. You promised me forever. I did, I whispered. But forever means letting go when you have to. She screamed. Not in anger. Not in rage. In grief. The sound shattered every light in the building. The water turned black, then white, then vanished altogether, sucked into the floor, into the cracks, into the spaces where her memory had lived for too long. And she faded, bit by bit, note by note, until there was only silence. When I woke, I was lying in the cove, alone, dry, the moon above me, the cavern empty, no water, no choir, no Corinne, just a single pearl in my hand, cracked, still warm. They found me wandering the cliffs days later. I don't know how long I'd been gone. Greystone burned to the ground. Official report says faulty wiring. They didn't mention the seaweed found in the vents or the salt water pooled in every hallway. No survivors. Except me. They sent me to another facility. It's quieter here. Cleaner. But every time I close my eyes, I see her. Not the siren. Not the ghost. Not the monster. Just Corinne. Standing on that shore again. Hair in the wind. Voice in the waves. Waiting. They ask me why I keep humming in my sleep. I tell them it's just a lullaby. Just a dream. But I know the truth. She isn't gone. She's beneath us all. Waiting for another voice to join hers. And me. I've stopped singing. Because if I ever sing again, she'll come back.